Hi, my name's Josh. I'm an alcoholic, also an atheist. Great to see y'all. Have to pardon me. I just actually started on a new medication, so my brain is moving at a slightly different speed than usual. This is a good thing, as I got diagnosed with, managed to get a ADHD diagnosis during lockdown when it became a lot more pronounced. I mention it in part because of, you know, like the medication and whatnot, but also because, like, after actually, you know, at age 41, getting an ADHD diagnosis is basically something I've had my entire life. It brings a lot of things kind of into focus. Let me see. Sharing my experience, strength, and hope. Start out with, I guess I'll tell you a little bit of my backstory. So I wasn't a love at first drink alcoholic. It took me a pretty long time to fall into drinking. Generally, like when I was in high school, growing up, I had like an aversion to kind of alcohol in general. It was something that my parents drank too much at parties, or like in high school, the kids who got drunk, it was seemed kind of like silly to like me and my friends, whereas we were the smart ones, you know, hanging out in the corner, smoking pot. So it was like kind of a late life thing. I went to college in the 2000s. I turned 21 in Chicago, and in Chicago on your ID they put a red bar on it if your birth date isn't far enough along for you to buy alcohol. So actually when I was living out there, I made a point around my birthday of going and getting my ID replaced, which you could do at like a place in the mall. They literally like printed them out, which was weird because in Los Angeles it takes like 3 months to get one sent to you. But I just got like a new ID without the red bar on it. I went to as many liquor stores as possible to see if I got carded. And apparently if you have like a massive beard in the winter, nobody bothers to card you probably most times of the year, actually. But the point of that is that I bought a whole bunch of alcohol for my, you know, 21st birthday party. And that stuff more or less stayed in my apartment until I left Chicago in like 2002, 2003, something like that. Gifted a bunch of like hard liquor to my upstairs neighbors. It wasn't until I came back home from college, back to Los Angeles, that, you know, I started, that I got kind of introduced to drinking. That was actually through, not really introduced to drinking. I wasn't unfamiliar with the concept. And I'd like, you know, done it intermittently. But it was the first time I worked on a music video set. And as one is wont to do, try to follow the cutest person on the set off of there and like get connected up with their circle of friends. And they connected me up with this group of friends. And they're like, hey, we're having this party out at the Pasadena house. You should come hang out. And it was just an utter freak show in the best possible way. There was a girl there, ate like light bulbs, did like geek acts like that. There are people in costumes. It was just like my kind of weirdos. And it was the first time that I had been in an environment where I think after that, it was just literally like, drinking can be fun. And I started hanging out with a guy from that group that I kind of refer to as my drinking mentor, still a hardcore drunk as best I can tell. But, you know, it's the person that taught me that, you know, I could show up to somebody's house with like, you know, a 24 pack and just sit around and shit around and have some beers and whatnot. And basically from there, I started doing set work. And what like really kicked it for me was I was working out of a mold shop. And there were like 10-hour days. It was one of those jobs that like you think you're getting paid well at, but you realize it's only because there's like 2 hours of OT every day and you're doing like 10-hour days, 5 days a week. And that was, it was like my first like real stable job after coming back from college. And, you know, I decided that I could wear like big boy pants and, you know, I work hard and I deserve the sorts of nice things that I want to get for myself. So, you know, it started being, it just started with a beer a night, but that was like a solid brickwork there. It was just every night it was a beer a night. And that was from go. That was from go. And you know, then it becomes two beers, and then instead of picking up like a six pack every 6 days, start picking up the 12 packs and the 24s. And that slow escalation lasted, I haven't done the hard numbers on it yet, but it's probably about like a decades long decline. And I won't go into all like the bumps in the road there, but you know, of course, going from beer to hard alcohol, switching from whiskey to vodka because it turned out that people could smell whiskey on me when I was hiking, because I like sweated out on the trail, which I also determined was the best hangover cure, was to go outside and hike excessively and sweat through all of it. Hiking and drinking was a big part of my story. Not doing both at the same time, but hiking and then drinking afterwards. And I had a drinking buddy for that. But yeah, that kind of, it just kept going on and on and on. And I had various jobs, which became, you know, increasingly more depressing, leaned into drinking a lot more and more until about like 2013. And that's kind of like where it hit a tipping point. I just quit a job at a shitty funeral home that I was working at, specifically a shitty one. And kind of went into a fugue state where I was just like, well, I'm not doing anything else with what little savings I have. So I moved out of my apartment, moved back into my parents' place, and then took my money and went up to Portland, Oregon, drove up there, gave my money to strippers and bars, hung out with my buddy in Oakland, came back, met a girl, and proceeded to enter a cycle of kind of, I don't know, there's this horrible trigger that switches in my head when I'm in a relationship, I guess, where I don't know, maybe like all the toxic masculine crap that kind of seeped into my head and got into my head otherwise when I was younger kind of meant like, hey, you've got a girlfriend, that's the sort of thing, and you can just kind of settle down. And hey, you know, honestly, I'd given up. I'd kind of given up. I had a girl that liked me, and I liked drinking, and I didn't like anything else, you know. And all the social events in my life kind of circulated around drinking. I wasn't down to like really do anything unless they served alcohol there or I could get alcohol in some way. And that escalated and escalated and escalated until basically, you know, I didn't have a girlfriend anymore, and I was just living off of unemployment checks and drinking in the basement. And escalated to one day when I was actually like trying to get clear of this long-standing gut problem that I'd had, where basically I'd get kind of sick sometimes if my stomach got too empty and I couldn't like top it off quite right. I've always had trouble eating enough, and I'd had like ulcerative colitis before as a result of it, and probably in combination with all the vodka. But that escalated to the point where one day I was kind of sitting in the living room trying to get like my stomach stabilized again, and I had a little thing of like trail mix that I'd gotten from work, and I was just eating the blandest stuff possible, like pretzels and like little Chex and whatnot, and trying to like keep my stomach stable. And it was like a sweet and salty mix, and I grabbed one of the sweet pieces of trail mix and put it in my mouth and immediately vomited for like the 30th time in a row. At this point, I hadn't been able to sleep for a week and hadn't been able to keep anything down for a week. And I checked myself into the hospital. I actually looked up on my phone where the nearest place with an urgent care was and got one of my neighbors to drive me, because you know, masking around and my family is, you know, a big part of my story and my history there too, you know. But yeah, I got a neighbor to drive me to the urgent care where I hung out for a while. And the doctor told me that I had pancreatitis, which was rather either the effect of being a very severe diabetic or really terrible, hardcore alcoholic. And when he said that, I was like, the second one. And that was like a click in my head. Like, there were a lot of moments during my drinking history where, you know, I would be drunk and being like, hey, you know what, I'm an alcoholic, like I'm totally a drunk at this point, like I'm getting the shakes, I do this shit like day in, day out, you know, like living off gin swigs in the morning. And, you know, when you're drunk, when I was drunk and thinking about that sort of thing, the concept depressed me. And that was a great idea to drink over it more, you know, just kind of like drown that out. So basically, I spent, I talked to the doctor, and he told me I had pancreatitis. And like I said, it was like a click. There is something in my head where he asked me, do you consider yourself to be an alcoholic? And I believe my actual response was like pragmatically, I can't disagree with that diagnosis. You know, I was like, I'm sitting here in a bed. I've apparently have to hospitalize myself for drinking. I guess I'm an alcoholic. And I am grateful for that. Just not for being an alcoholic, but, you know, I guess a grateful alcoholic, but that, you know, I had that kind of like that very kind of like clear turning over point. I spent 10 days in the hospital, which was entirely passable because they had Turner Classic Movies on the television there. There's great lineups, day and night. That's where to put the pregnant pause, right, Josh? Turner Classic Movies. I got out of the hospital and I didn't stay. I stayed sober for, you know, the number fluctuates a lot in my head. I feel like it was a month, might have been 3 months. I managed to white knuckle my way through it for a while. And then at one point my friend invited me out to a show, who didn't know what I was in the hospital for. And so during one of the intermissions, I'm like, oh, I've been doing good. I'll just go out to the lobby and get myself a vodka tonic. Could have done so good. I feel like I got this thing under control now. And of course, I go out and I get another one, paying way too much for it because it's at a venue. She drives me back home afterwards. And then I hop back in my car, go down to the liquor store, buy another bottle of vodka. This went back and forth a few times, though the timing is very difficult to track. I ended up in the hospital in November of 2015, and my sobriety date is April of 2016. So about that much bouncing back and forth, and basically kind of the same thing. I got this under control. Oh, I don't have this under control. And I would disappear, like just time would disappear. I'd be like, I'm only going to go under for like a week or something like this. But I'd be gone for a month or two or something. And that kind of escalated. I remember I had lunch with my ex at one point, who had stopped drinking out of solidarity, because she had been there for not the worst of it, but bad enough to leave me. We were having lunch together, and she was very, very apologetically explaining to me how she had like gone to a club and she had a drink and she felt bad. And, you know, it wasn't something she was going to like do again. And at that point, I was like, oh, no, that's fine. I relapsed too. And she just gave me that death stare. And I was like, it's fine. You can leave if you're disgusted with me or whatnot. And she goes, you know what? I don't care. You do with your life what you can. But yeah, I mean, I believe it was, she said, I'm not going to your fucking funeral if you die like this. You need to get some help. And that was a point at which I, when I got home, I went online and I looked up, I Googled atheist AA, and agnostic AA came up, and I went, good enough. Oh, excuse me. Stupid kitchen robot. Sorry about that. chooses weirdest damn times. I looked up atheist AA, found agnostics, and I went to a Friday night in-person meeting in Hollywood hidden in the parking garage underneath Kaiser Sunset. And the We Agnostics group, basically, as I said before, I'm atheist. I was pretty much raised that way, if you can be raised atheist. I had a brief, period during my childhood where I kind of entertained the concept of a sky beard, but only in like a really abstract way. And I had known for a long time the religious overtones of like 12-step AA, and basically had like a built-in aversion to that. And when I found the We Agnostics group, I think they definitely asked me to talk the first time that I was there. And it was really nice. I don't remember super much from that time. I don't remember super much from like the early meetings. You know, I just have like a lot of holes in my memory that way, and I was pretty shredded up. But I got people that can tell me what I looked like when I came in. But what it was, the vibe about the meeting that worked for me was it was just folks kind of sitting around talking about, you know, a shared problem. You know, there wasn't a whole lot of big book banging. You know, some people are just like, hey, I like these steps and I do the thing and whatnot. But it was never, it was never like the central thrust of it. It was never a book study meeting. It was always just kind of people with a mutual problem getting together in a room and talking about their shit. And I don't know what happened or what clicked my first night in that room, but I left and I didn't want to drink as much. And I'm kind of a tortoise in a lot of ways. I move very slowly. I didn't become like, you know, super hardcore into the program or anything, or check out a lot of meetings. This is again in the before times when it was like dominantly in-person stuff. And I was lucky to be, you know, close to two of the three agnostics meetings in Los Angeles. It was something like that at the time. I could be wrong on that number, but it was like two of them were in Hollywood and one of them was like in Culver City, you know, and that's like what I knew about back then. But I just consistently went to the Friday night, and that was my program, you know, it was just going. And I took notes. I started just writing everything down. Whenever somebody said something that like stuck out to me or something that I related to, I wrote it down. I don't know if I ever like even really went back over those journals. Sometimes writing it down is like the part of the process that I need. But that was me. And I did that for a while and expanded meetings after a while, started going to like, you know, Tuesday night and whatnot. And meantime, in the background, I started working on this sort of positivity exercise that I found like through a friend, and that was like really bolstering me up. And super early on in my recovery, I was able to get a job at a theme park doing something that I didn't think I would do before. I ended up getting a job over at a theme park playing cartoon characters, you know. People run around in the mascot suits and whatnot and sweat a lot and pretend that they're cartoon characters. Yeah, and it was like a different world for me. It was like this it was kind of this spiritual transition. Like, I mean, I'd been working at the theme park before, working like dominantly Halloween stuff, and I've been doing that while I was like drinking, not drinking at work, but getting off work at night and you know, getting drunk and showing up to work the next morning. And I was doing, you know, Halloween stuff. I was scaring people, and that put me in a great position to like spiritually hate guests, to be angry. That was kind of like my scary motivation, was like, you know, I was fueled by rage and anger and whatever pent-up crap I had inside. And when I moved over to the park and started working cartoon characters, that transitioned. At my height, I played dominantly female characters. And the first one I got assigned was Marge Simpson, and I fell in love with that. And sometimes I cite her as my higher power, which is, that's my path to recovery. Get a cartoon character job, dress up as America's most beloved mother, and you know, bask in the love and adulation of strangers. it works pretty well if you can manage it, but don't compete with me on my roster. But yeah, it was a fascinating experience because, like, as a performer, I kind of like put myself into that mindset of, you know, the world's most tolerant mom, most like, you know, enduring woman in animation history. You know, I mean, just like it, just resilience and strength and love and acceptance, and that became it, that part felt more me than the parts of me that I was coming from, if that makes sense. But that was just like one of the benefits of sobriety, was just it being able to approach that in a new way and a new light. Yeah, so that's pretty much my relative amount of my story so far. So far as the and yeah, just from there, I've been, you know, going to more and more groups during lockdown. That definitely expanded to, like, you know, kind of like break international borders. And this is just great to me, like Zoom era stuff, as much as like some of us may have issues with it. I've always thought that, you know, from that first meeting forward, there always seemed to be this sort of lightning in the bottle sort of approach to AA, where there's this like adherence to ritual and the way that it's laid out in the book as it's laid out in the book, because nobody knows where like the magic secret of it is. You know, is it the steps? Is it the submitting yourself before yada yada? Is it finding a higher power? Is it this, that, or the other thing? And again, I just go back to like what I first saw in that room. One of the reasons that I like these Tuscanoora rooms so much is because it's very much that vibe, is just people showing up and talking about their experiences. You know, it's there's only like this very limited window that we can see the world through, and it's our own. And like, you know, one of the things that I found with like, you know, my ADHD diagnosis is nobody else knows really like the circus that's going on in my head, you know. But being able to, you know, talk openly around other people about our experience with problems, especially things that have like a lot of stigma associated with them, that we tend to diminish. I feel like that shared experience is lightning in the bottle. And via your experience, via each other's experience, I can make progress that I wouldn't. I can see angles that I wouldn't have otherwise. I can get experiences, or I can, you know, I can flesh out my understanding of like what I'm going through. So that's always that's always kind of the thing that I've really enjoyed in rooms. I do have a book on my shelf here. It's been so long. I've been working the night shift for a minute, so I'm kind of spaced out on all of my projects. But what is it? The book on the 12 Steps Without God. Been meaning to come around to that, and kind of start going through the program that way and kind of like doing some more of like the fine nitty gritty work. But for me, be it Aberrant or whatnot, I've always kind of found that my number one tool is just, you know, kind of showing up in rooms and listening and trying to be present and, you know, kind of trying to stay in touch with it. You know, there were times early on where, you know, it was all drunk logs and all, you know, a lot of shadow work, a lot of embracing the abyss, a lot about talking about the worst possible things we possibly did. And I shy away from it like a little bit more now. Not that I'm avoidant to engage it, but you know, it's only so much time I need to spend staring into that. And there's time that I like to hear about other people's stuff and their experience, strength, and hope, and what they're going through and how they're doing. And it looks like I've hit about the 25 minute mark, which impressed even me. So yeah, I will hand it over at this point, and I will take some valuable time to listen to what y'all say, because man, being a secretary makes it hard to do that. Thank you so much for being here.